Okay, we left off last time. Rav Soloveitchik began explaining that the focus and the goal of cognitive man, of scientific man of the world, contemporary man, upon encountering the world, upon encountering reality, his main goal is to conquer and to understand, to unravel the mystery of creation. And he doesn't want any obscurity, any secrets. He right away wants to have principles, and he wants to understand what the world is about. He seeks to fathom what makes everything tick. Then we left off last time that any phenomenon which cannot be subjected to a microscope, to a scientific lab, that can't be understood in a lab, so that's subjected to the rule of, that's subjected to nothingness, or at least hylic matter of Aristotle. And we spent last week explaining what that means, that according to Plato and Aristotle, the world as we see now is a final version, whatever, according to both opinions, whether we say hylic matter of Aristotle or Plato's nothingness, the realms, etc. Let's continue the bottom of page 5. The common denominator of both the Platonic and Aristotelian views is that the random and the particular are not deemed worthy of being granted the status of the real and existent. Again, according to both Plato and Aristotle, the common denominator, according to this view, the scientific view, the philosophical view, the cognitive intellectual view, one that seeks to function only with intellect and to understand everything, in that view, the random and the particular are not deemed worthy of being granted status of the real. We're not looking for the particulars. We're looking to set up laws. There's a very, everyone knows that today one of the most dangerous aspects of modern science and modern psychology, according to some schools, is what Viktor Frankl, the great psychologist, the existential psychologist, that did not buy the mechanical view of the human being and sort of reducing the human being to an animal and to a machine, like the rest of the world, and hence seeking to define and relate to humanity as just a bunch of chemicals and an organism that functions like an animal, etc. So Frankl called that reductionism. Reductionism means to reduce human beings to being just another species, a Homo sapien being another species like another one of the species of the world. And the danger of that, of course, is because when you're not looking anymore at the particular, you're not looking at the random, you're looking at everything as rules and as an assembly line, one very often fails to see the differences that there are between people and the subtle differences that there are between human beings and the rest of the world, and people cannot just be put into boxes all the time. That, of course, is very dangerous, especially when a person, when we try to approach ourselves or approach other people with always rules and laws. It's very, very tempting always to put boxes and to put ourselves into boxes, and to people into boxes and to rules. It's always important to remember that we can't be reduced. We're not just an assembly line, and everybody is different. The way when Chazal teach, when the sages teach, that every person is an Olam Mole, right? Everyone knows Chazal teach the Mishnah. It's a Mishnah in Sanhedrin. It's one of the reasons that man was created by himself, to teach that a person is an Olam Mole, a whole world. So it doesn't just mean vis-a-vis a person's worth, that it's important to save a person vis-a-vis a person's worth. When we say that, when Chazal taught that every person is a world, it also means that everybody's different. There are no two people that are exactly the same. And that's the danger of trying to think that one could have rules, and I'm not talking about whether you're a teacher in a classroom or even a professional in certain fields, and one tries to reduce everyone into certain rules and regulations and boxes. It's very dangerous. Which, of course, again, goes back to why Chazal say never to judge another person, be judgmental, not to judge another person until you're in their place, because every person has their own reality that one really can't relate to unless you're in that world. So the common denominator of these schools is that the random and the particular are not deemed worthy of being granted status of the real and existent, and they remain in the realm of chaos and the void. Only that which is fixed, clear, and ordered, only that which is engraved with the imprint of lawful reality, only something that you could say has the imprint of lawful reality, that has an order, that's part of a seder, only that merits the appellation and title of true or effective being. in which the idea participates. So we're going to get into this later on. We'll speak about it in the bottom of the page. Only that in the philosophy of Plato and Aristotle, there's such a thing called true effective being, ontos on in Greece, which means true ontological status. There are different, according to Plato and Aristotle, the different realms of ontology, which we learned ontology means the philosophy of learning being, existence. And there are all different types of existence, and there are different realms of existence, how much something really exists or not. Just give you a very simple example what that means. Just to have a better understanding, what does it mean? What does Rav Soloveitchik mean to say over here? True or effective being? What's the ineffective being? What's not an effective being? What's true ontological status? What does he mean over here? If I were to say to you, an idea, a svara sichlis, an intellectual idea, an idea, a whole is the sum of its parts. The burden of proof is on the plaintiff. Amaitzim echaver ala varaya. Right? Those are ideas. An idea, the whole is the sum of its parts. The burden of proof is on the plaintiff. 1 + 1 = 2. These are all ideas, right? Do those intellectual ideas exist other than when people think about them? Let's say that nuclear Armageddon, all human beings would cease to exist. Nobody was thinking that the whole is the sum of its parts. Nobody is thinking that the burden of proof is on the plaintiff. Would that idea still exist? So seemingly you would say the l'chaira not, right? It's just like the famous the tree in the Amazon forest, that if nobody ever sees it, there's no way to know if it exists. To exist is to be perceived, right? Nobody knows. You can't prove it if it exists or not. So seemingly the tree could only... Now, of course, that of course is a philosophical question whether the tree exists or not. But I think we all understand that pure logic seems to say that it exists, the tree. We can't prove it. But it exists. Nobody sees it. When you see it, it's not that when you see it, the tree comes into existence, even though there were philosophers that said that. But if we're talking pure logic, the tree exists. What happens when you see it? Something that existed, you're now able to see. So ideas exist seemingly, whether you're aware of them or not. When you now become aware of an idea, your mind's eye now sees it. But the idea was there before your mind's eye saw it, right? The idea was there. If no human beings would exist anymore, the whole would still equal the sum of its parts. 1 + 1 would still equal 2, even if there were no apples and oranges to put together to show that 1 and 1 is 2. 1 and 1 would still be 2. The burden of proof would still be on the plaintiff, even though if there were no people. So an idea exists. It exists. It doesn't exist within the realm of physicality, but it exists. Now, let's go a step deeper. What exists more, that idea or this stender right here, this piece of wood? What exists more? What has more existence? So a person that doesn't think too deeply will say, seemingly, the stender. I could knock on it. I could feel it, right? So seemingly it exists more. Well, let me ask you a question. How long could this stender exist for? How many years? A couple of hundred years? A couple of thousand years? Is it necessary existence? Could be a fire will come and destroy it. So its existence is contingent existence on a couple of factors, that a couple of thousand years don't pass, that there's no fire, that there's no atomic war. There are a couple of factors that necessitate for this to exist. So it's a contingent existence that needs certain circumstances to exist. So it's not, in the language of philosophy, a real existence. An idea exists and always will. 1 and 1 will always equal 2. A whole is always equal to the sum of its parts. So an idea, not only does an idea exist, it has more of an ontological status than this stender over here. It's forever, right? It's forever, and ideas are forever. So that means we talk about... And by the way, that's what Chassidus explains. Chassidism explains when you speak about godliness. And remember, we spoke last week that godliness is ayin. Ayin is nothingness. Even though we say that it's nothingness and we call the world a yesh, it's a something. The truth is, we mentioned last week, that the divine nothingness is more real in the world. It's the real entity of what the world is. In other words, we're used to defining existence as what? Something that you could touch. If I can't touch it, it doesn't really exist. Though, if you stop for a second and you think, you know that the deepest things in life, friendship, love, appreciation, all these type of things, are not things you could touch, at least with your hands. So if you think a little deeper, you realize that it's not the things that you necessarily could bang on that exist. True existence is deeper than that. So the different levels of ontological status, right? Now, even Plato, which we're going to mention, we're going to speak about a little more in depth, even Plato that believed in the realm of the ideas, even Plato said, but the ideas also have to have order. There has to be a set order to them. If there's no order, that's what Rav Soloveitchik, the Rav is saying over here, if there's no order, then it's chaos on the void. Even he said there has to be some kind of order in order to participate in lawful reality. And if only if it has this lawful reality, is it effective being? Does it have ontus on, true ontological status, in which the idea participates? The idea participates in something that has a specific type of existence. Only then could the idea participate in it. Again, I'll explain better what the idea means in a couple of lines. The attitude of disdain and contempt to that which is not fixed, not lawful, and not ordered. Look at these words. An attitude of disdain. It's unbelievable because it's very, you could see how the whole scientific mind is not new. That scientific mind of not wanting to be able to not to be able to define something, it goes back to the Greeks. The attitude of disdain and contempt to that which is not fixed, not lawful, and not ordered, which was so prevalent in the teachings of the Greek philosophers, and which found its most acute expression in the philosophies of Plato and Aristotle, this is the eternal Greek legacy to all cognitive and scientific men. The eternal Greek legacy is disdain for that which is not understood by the mind, which cannot be proven, which cannot be ordered, that cannot be fixed. That's the eternal Greek legacy to all cognitive and scientific men. The alpha and omega of existence is its lawfulness. You know, alpha and omega are the first and last letters of the Greek alphabet. Alpha is the first letter of the Greek alphabet. Omega is the last letter of the Greek alphabet. So when you say the alpha and omega, it's like in Hebrew saying, ani rishon v'ani achron, the first and last, right? The alpha and omega, the first and last of existence, is its lawfulness. Now, when I saw this, Rav Soloveitchik writes this, and of course it's true, but when I saw Rav Soloveitchik write it so strongly, that the legacy of Greece is seichel. Seichel. Intellect. Cognition. Understanding. So of course that brought to mind what we all know about Hanukkah, right? We've all learned about Hanukkah, that Greece is seichel, is choshech, and they don't have faith, their whole thing is intellect. And lawfulness, that's the usual Hanukkah Torah, right? That their whole thing, that what Rav Soloveitchik is saying over here. And we know what Chazal say, that Kisrael Keren Ashor, Shein Lechem Chelek B'Kei Yisrael, that the Greeks made the Jews ride on the horn of the ox, that they have no portion, Elokei Yisrael, the God of Israel. And Chassidus explains that means the Elokus, the godliness, because they were only able to deal with the rational. That's what we all know about Hanukkah Torah. But you know what always bothered me about that? Does Greek mythology seem to you very rational? I mean, this whole thing about Greeks being like these rational, you know, cool, composed, scientific human beings, I don't know, Thor and Oedipus and Medusa and all these Chevra, Homer and all these guys, it doesn't exactly seem to be like, you know, the most scientific and rational things. How does that fit exactly? So I'll tell you. You think a little deeper, you understand that it not only is irrational, but it's lawful and orderly. Like, it's physical, right?
Everyone has their own job.
Oh, that's the var. That's the var, right? And I was like this. When Chazal say that the Greeks did not want, that the Greeks said, "Ein lechem chelek b'kei Yisrael," you have no portion in the godliness of Israel. That they didn't want godliness. They were prepared for such an idea of theology, but not elokus. What does it mean that they didn't believe in elokus and godliness? They had gods. Not only did they believe in God, they believed in a lot of gods, right? So they had godliness, seemingly. Anyone remember, what a Chazal say? I think it's very intuitive. What a Chazal say? What are the three things, in that same medrash, in that same place, what a Chazal say, the three things that the Greeks decreed against? Shabbos, Milan, Rosh Chodesh. What do all three of those things say to you? Ayin. What's Shabbos? Shabbos is our testimony that the world was created, that there's above nature. What is Mila? Mila means, circumcision means the ability to change nature, the ability to refine nature. That nature as is not necessarily the end all be all, right? We all know the famous, the Chazal, that the matronisa, the princess came to Roman or Greek, whatever, a Hellenistic princess came to Rabbi Akiva and said, if God wanted a circumcision, he should have created with a circumcision. He should have created the world in such ways. Rabbi Akiva said, do you ever eat termusin? I always forget how to translate. And termusin is, I guess, turnips, whatever, one of these types of vegetables that you have to boil. So she said, yeah. So he said, how do you eat it? So she says, I boil it. So Rabbi Akiva says, well, why don't you just eat it without boiling it? I mean, what's the mashal? The point of the mashal is that things in this world have to be changed and have to be rectified. So Mila symbolizes that nature as is has to be fixed, has to be repaired, right? And of course, what's Rosh Chodesh? What's the idea of Chodesh? What's the idea of Rosh Chodesh? Renewal, rebirth. I spoke a little about Shabbos morning, changing, being able to be born again, to change and to fix and to renew again. That what you have right now doesn't always have to be. And that, of course, you understand that all these three things come from tapping into the ayin. Now, there was the Motzei Shabbos, we spoke a little about this. Tapping into the ayin, har mismatcha, yeah? Once one taps into the place of ayin, the place of divine nothingness, that's what Shabbos meal and Rosh Chodesh are. What does it mean to be above nature, to be able to renew oneself, to change the world, the miraculous? All these things come from tapping into the place of ayin, that place of God, of godliness that's above the orderly world, the transcendent. And that transcendent, that place of nothingness, at that place where God's light has not yet manifested in any particulars, one can change the world and one could do tshuva and one could renew oneself. And there's a command and there's a responsibility to change the world and to fix the world, etc. That's what these three things are saying. So with the Greeks, when we spoke about that they wanted lawfulness and intellect and rationalism, it means that everything by them had to be in order. There had to be a set order to things. And you understand the same thing comes with the gods. The idea of the gods, as Blazer said, is that they needed to put labels on everything. They needed to put labels on things. They needed to put an order to the chaos. They weren't comfortable with the chaos, with the disorder. Everything had to be set. You know that one of the hardest things in one of all religions, including Judaism, to accept is that God is multifaceted. That God has a complex personality, right? That it's all one. It all comes from the one. All the religions back then believed that there were at least two powers. Why? Why was Zoroastrianism and Menacheism and all these polytheistic religions, they all believed that there was the God of light and the God of darkness. Why? Because God is complicated. He's very complex. It's hard to put a label on him. We say every day, by the way, in davening, Yotzer Or Uborei Choshech. He creates light and he fashions light and he creates darkness. Anyone remember where does that pasuk really say? What is Borei Ra? It's a pasuk in Yeshaya, Yotzer Or Borei Ra. It's not just light and darkness; it's light and evil. Borei Ra. Hashem is the one that creates evil, and it's the same Hashem Echad. It's the same one God. And for the Greeks, by them, everything had to. Yeah, they had mythology and everything, but it was all about, again, lawfulness. So this was the god of thunder, and this was the one of grass, and this was the one of love, and this was the one of war, and everything had its own different power. It was all part of having to put things into labels. You know, there's a maisa, Mendel Futterfass. One time, he had a very hard life. And he underwent a very, very difficult thing in his life. And he sat by a Verbrengen, took a little mashke, so he drank a little. And then he gave a krechts, he gave a sigh, and he says, Oh, Rebbeinu Shalom, bist nicht kein Mensch, bist taken nicht kein Mensch. God, you're really not a mensch. Now, is that an insult or it's not an insult? It's true. God is not a man. He's not a man, right? God is not a man. So he says, "Bistakenish kan mensch," but you understand the connotation, right? You're not he's not a man. What does he mean to say? That the Rebbeinu Shel Pashut, we can't understand him, right? He has all these different aspects, and the same God that creates babies creates all the evil things in the world. Slish kan mensch. He's complex. The Greeks couldn't handle such a thing. They needed everything to be labeled. They needed everything to be orderly. It has to make sense. How could I accept it? It doesn't fit my logic that the same God should make so many contradictory things. But you all understand that having a deep relationship with someone means what? Accepting their complexities, right? To have a really deep relationship with someone means that you have to accept their complexities, you have to know that they're complicated. That there might even be people that have chaotic personalities. But if you want to have a deep relationship with somebody, then you know they have a chaotic personality, they have aspects of their personality that you don't like, but you accept the whole picture. That's what it means to have a relationship. That you know that the person has different aspects to them, it's not lawful. There's chaos. There's so many different things going on. But yet you know that this is a complete picture and you're not looking for labels. You're not looking for textbooks and a manual to tell me exactly how does this work and how does that work. You know that a relationship means accepting all the different facets of that person. And with God is the same thing. That's where Mendel Futov, as I gave a class, you're not a mensch, but I love you anyway. But the Greeks, it was unsettling for them. It was too unsettling. It was too hard for them to accept that. Hence, they had to come up with this whole scheme of different gods and goddesses and all these explanations, etc. Remember when I was in Eretz Yisrael, I'll tell you an interesting story. I'll say the name because as far as he's concerned, it's not Lashon Hara. So I could say the name. My Rosh Yeshiva when I was in Eretz Yisrael was Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, Zichrono Livracha. Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, Zichrono Livracha, was not a very big fan of the Hasidic movement, to say the least, even though he himself came from Slonim or Tzadikim, the Rebbes, etc. But he was not a very big fan of the Hasidic movement. And we clashed a few times. We had a couple of close encounters of the third kind. So I remember one time, you know, he gave, by Shalashudas, he used to get up and he would give I don't know exactly how to explain it, it was some sort of philosophy. He had a very interesting type of way of philosophically explaining things. And he got up with this whole thing and he was speaking about good and evil and whatever. And I don't remember exactly what he said, but I do remember that I was a chutzpinyak, always was. And I went over to him afterwards, and, you know, because he was sort of implying there are certain shitas, I'm not getting into it now, but I'm sure you know there are opinions even within Judaism that sort of seem to say that evil is an absence of God. There are certain theories, there are certain those that do believe such a thing, how they, for the psukim, we're not going to get into that now. The whole idea of theodicy, it's too big to speak about now. Whatever. But I went over to him, and he was sort of making reference to those things, and I went over to him, and I said to him, the Rosh Hashiva should forgive me, but Yadu, the Remeril Premishlaner, that Remeril Premishlaner, Nebuch Nishdog Gedacht, Nishav Kenem Gedacht, lost a son, and by the funeral, he made a Toiva Meitiv, right? instead of dying Amis, we know that God forbid nobody should know from it, loses a relative, one makes a Bracha dying Amis, and upon a birth or a good thing, you say a Toiva Meitiv, you make a Bracha Toiva Meitiv. So I told him the Remeril Premishlaner was so penetrated, so completely filled with this idea that everything is godliness, that he made a Teva Meitiv at his son's funeral, and he was dancing. So Yaakov Weinberg said to me, it was a bracha in vain, it was a blessing in vain. So I'm not taking sides here, okay? I'm not getting into that bechlal. But the idea is that, again, I'm not taking sides here, but there's definitely such a thing. It depends how you look at it. Remeir Premishlaner was saying that they're both God, and therefore have to make a Teva Meitiv on both. Maharsha Shiva was saying they're both God and make a Dain Emes. They're both God, so Taka make a Dain Emes, and it's still Hashem. Dain Emes is speaking about God. He's the Dain. So it depends how you look at it. It's two sides of it. They're both saying the same thing. Be'etzim. They're both the Rebbeinu Shel Olam. So he was saying, so make a Teva Meitiv. Right? The Rebbe always says over, I'm sure you've heard it from Rebbe many times, the famous Maisa that someone came over to the Blujava Rebbe in Auschwitz and said to him, now you still believe what the Baal Shem Tov taught, that God is even an evil. You're able to believe that even over here in Auschwitz, now you still believe what the Baal Shem Tov said, Einam Olvadei. How could you relate to it now? So the Blujava Rebbe said that the Berditcheva, the first night of Sukkot, was one night raining. First night of Sukkot. And everyone knows that the first night of Sukkot, it rains. You can't do the mitzvah. Unless you're one of these crazy fanatical chassidim that make a bracha and eat in the Sukkot even when it's raining. Like we do in Lavich, the Munkach, whatever. But most normal people, according to Halacha, you can't make a bracha. You're not supposed to sit in the Sukkot. The Berditcheva came out, and it was raining, and he started dancing. And the chassidim said to him, Rebbe, it says it's a gemara over there in Sukkah, that it's a kilu shafach kisan al panav, that it's like a servant brings a cup of water to the master and he spills it in his face. Why are you dancing? The tatot gegeben a patch, they said to the Rebbe. The tatot gegeben a patch. Our father gave us a slap. So the Beditshva gave a big smile and he says, when the tata get a patch, me feel the tata's hand. When the father gives you a slap, you're still feeling your father's hand. So it's still a reason to dance. The patience and understanding are the elements of a relationship where you accept the multifaceted aspects of that personality, and even though some annoy you, you know that it's yoitzer or ubayre ra. That's what the Greeks couldn't understand, that there's such a thing as ayin, there's a divine nothingness that's able to penetrate everything. You're not able to categorize. You can't label God all the time. You can't label people all the time either. There's this taiva that everything has to have a label, everything has to be ordered. Everything has to have a label and be understood. That's the legacy of the Greeks. That's what happens when everything has to be understood with the intellect. Let's go further. Now, to be sure, says the Rav, the concept of lawfulness assumes different forms depending upon the philosophical mood of the age and the perspective of inquiry. In other words, he says, that cognitive search, that need to put labels, those labels took different names as the generations went on. As the years went on in different eras, different epochs, different scientific moods. So there are different labels that they put on, right? Today, everything is, you know, everything has different labels in different times. Today, everything is, you know, high maintenance, low maintenance, right? High maintenance, low maintenance came from a movie from the 90s. And all of a sudden, everyone today is either high maintenance or low maintenance. Everything has different labels. Everything has different ways of categorizing things of that age. And today, everything is, you know, very scientifically inclined. Everything. And every generation has its own way of categorizing. So then the Rav now, from now to the next couple lines, he's going to give three examples, just so we should keep what's going on over. He's now going to give three examples of how things were changed, were categorized as the generations proceeded. He gives three examples. Throughout the Middle Ages, in accordance with the Aristotelian approach, the concept of lawfulness was identified with the imminent theological process of the idea or the forms. Okay, now that's quite a mouthful. Throughout the Middle Ages, in accordance with Aristotelian approach, the concept of lawfulness was identified with the imminent theological process of the idea or the forms. Let's explain what that means. It's a very interesting idea, and it's very relevant in Yiddishkeit. So it's kedai to know, to learn what this idea is. It's an idea of Aristotle that became very prevalent in Yiddishkeit. The imminent theological process of the idea or the forms. So first we have to understand, we've made reference to this already a while ago, the machlekes between Plato and Aristotle. We made reference to this. And here's the place to explain a little more barichos. So like this. Let's give an example. When we speak about what it means to be, to exist, there are a lot of different interpretations of what it means to exist. As we spoke, I mentioned a little at the beginning of the class, what does it mean that something exists? Let's give an example. You have a tall black horse. A tall black horse. Yeah. So we say that there are different things over here. There's a horse. There's the fact that it's tall. There's the fact that it's black. Those are all realms of, those are all types of existence. There's the existence of the horse, the existence of the fact that it's tall, the existence of the fact that it's black. Now, right away, what do we have to differentiate between? The essence and the particulars, the subject and the predicates. You have the subject, you have the horse, you have the actual horse, the substance of the horse, and the predicates, the adjectives, the aspects of the horse, correct? That we have to write or differentiate. You have tall, you have black, and you have horse. Do tall and black exist without horse? Is there such a thing as the existence of tall or black without horse? Seemingly not. Plato said there is. Plato said, of course there is. Because if a horse is tall, and a house is tall, and a chair could be tall, so then there must be something called tallness. Well, let's take an easier example. Beauty. It's the easiest example. Because a child is beautiful. A painting is beautiful, a sunset is beautiful, a table could be beautiful. There are a lot of different things that partake of beauty. So if I would ask you to define what's beauty, well, these are all ways that beauty is manifesting. What is beauty then? What about goodness? What does it mean to be good? Helping an old lady cross the street is good. Chocolate chip cookie is good. What's good? What does it mean to good? What's good? Plato therefore taught that all these ideas, all these particulars, exist in an ethereal realm. That's called the theory of ideas or forms. That's what he was referring to at the beginning of the page also. Forms or ideas, that they exist. There are realms between, before you get to the physical world, from the one, the absolute one that Plato believed emanated from him, blackness, tallness, beauty, good, red, green, bad, ideas. Horses. Not all horses look the same. To us they do, but they don't, right? Not all horses look the same. So there's an absolute horse. There's the essential horse, a realm called horseness, a realm called good, a realm, an idea called tall. And Plato taught that the universal ideas are the ultimate reality. These spiritual realms are the ultimate reality. Again, very reminiscent of the idea of the spheres, of the spherot, of the idea of the divine letters, the oisius of the olive bays, which Kabbalah speaks about. There are these ultimate ideas of good, of beauty, etc. And all the things down here below partake of these attributes of these spiritual realms. They then translate down here below. In other words, according to Plato, what we see over here is just a... Remember we spoke about a long time ago, the Mashal, his famous parable of the cave with the shadows? Remember we spoke about? Spoke about the cave and the shadows, that a person that was born and lived his whole life in a cave and just saw on the wall shadows. Just shadows from the outside world. And somebody came and said to them, he's chained into this cave, and he says, these shadows that you see, that's not reality. These are just shadows of what's going on outside. And Plato taught that that's what philosophy has to do. The world that we see is just a shadow of these supernal realms. That's what Plato called the idea of the ideas and the forms. In other words, everything you see is a manifestation, a physical manifestation of the ultimate predicate, the ultimate place where these things really exist. Aristotle did not agree with this. Aristotle believed that to say that the reality is not concrete, it was untenable, was unprovable, there's no way to prove it. And Aristotle was very much scientific. You remember we spoke about this at length a couple of weeks ago. Aristotle pointed down here below and said no. Remember we spoke about the painting from Raphael, School of Athens, with Plato and Aristotle. Plato pointing upwards, Aristotle pointing downwards. Aristotle's philosophy is very grounded. And he said, no, the particular is more real than the universal. In other words, tallness and blackness do not exist without the essence. The predicates can't exist without the subject. There's no such thing as beauty without particular things that are beautiful. In other words, we could cognitively distinguish different aspects of different entities. We're able to cognitively distinguish and say that different things have different... We could say, this is beautiful and that's beautiful. So in our minds, we say, wow, there's something called beauty that relates to this object and that object, but that does not mean that there's such a thing as beauty void of any particular object. Aristotle did not believe of a transcendent realm. What he did believe, however, and here it's Yadu, everyone says where Aristotle sort of, he tried to rebel against his teacher, but he wasn't quite successful. Because then after like negating what Plato spoke about and saying that everything is imminent, he then goes on to say something that seems very mystical. And he goes on and he says, Aristotle says, what there are, however, there might not be realms, upper realms. So then what becomes the question? Let's ask for a second. What was Aristotle then bothered by? If there are no upper realms bringing about the details of an object, so what's the question we have to ask? Where do the details come from? Where do the details come from? What makes the form of the matter? There's matter and there's form. In Hebrew, chomer and tzura, matter and form. So if there's no supernal realm from which details are manifesting, why do things become different in different ways? Why do things become have a particular form? So Aristotle taught this idea, that's what he's quoting here, the theological process of the idea or the forms, which means Aristotle taught, try to listen, that every particular object has a form from the moment of its inception until it goes out of existence. There is a form, and this form is inherent within the object, and the object's whole being is constantly trying to what? To reach its perfection of that form. In other words, why does a horse, is it black and it's tall and it has this type of hair? There's the form of this particular horse. And from the moment that it's born, like you would say, the tree is the form of the seed. And the seed is always trying to evolve. It's a dynamic process that it's trying to become and to manifest as its form. There's almost this ethereal concept that everything has a form, and everything is trying to evolve to become the form that it's supposed to be. Anyone know what that's called in Hebrew? What Chazal, what the old tzaddikim refer to that as? This Aristotelian idea?
Give us a hint.
Tzura and Chomer has to do with matter and form. His gabrus atzura al hachomer. You ever see that idea? It's in Musar all the time. His gabrus atzura al hachomer. The conquering of the form over matter. Form conquering matter. Which means you have matter and you have the form that it's supposed to become. The Balei Musar love this. You're supposed to become an Adam, a person, an Adam Asholim. Adam Hashem, you being the best that you're supposed to be, or in the Reb Zusha story, being that Zusha should become Zusha, right? That means that Zusha should become the form what Zusha is supposed to become. And your whole life is trying that the Tzura should be Mizgabra on the Chaymer. That form, that's what it means, the imminent theological process of the idea. Teleological means that something has a purpose to it, a goal. That there's an idea, there's a form that you are supposed to become, and you have to work to evolve to become, you'll forgive me for using it, stealing it from the army, to be all that you can be, right? To be all that you could be means to reveal this form that's inherent within you, in potential, but you have to, teleologically, you have to come that purpose with a purpose, this goal of developing it within you. Very depressing is that Aristotle said then eventually you reach that ultimate perfection of being the best form that you're supposed to be, and then you begin right, what's it called? The other side of the hill, right? Then you begin decaying. And of course, in Yiddishkeit, we do not believe that. In Yiddishkeit, we believe, actually, it's very interesting. The Lubavitch Rebbe had interesting sikhas we spoke about against retiring. Whole sikhas we spoke about against this whole American idea of going on retirement. Then he spoke about the opposite. Then Judaism, the older you become, the more mishuchlal, wie sagt man, developed person becomes. You reach even higher levels of form because form is intellect. The ultimate surah is seichel. The ultimate surah is intellect, and that becomes more refined as the years go on. Supposed to. By the way, interesting story. Stam, I remind myself that there was a certain chassid. Him and his wife went into the Lubavitch Rebbe to Yechidus once. And I don't know if anyone ever heard, when the Rebbe spoke, he very often coughed. He would very often clear his throat all the time. He would clear his throat a lot. And so they were in Yechidus, and this woman was an older woman. He knew the Rebbe from Russia before he was Rebbe, so she felt that she was Mizak Min Haimish. You know, she knew the Rebbe from before he was Rebbe, so she was one of those that felt, you know, she would think even she was older, that she was older than the Rebbe, and so she felt that she, you know. And they were in Yechidus, and the Rebbe kept coughing, So she said, in Yiddish, maybe you should go to a doctor, maybe get the cough checked out. So Rebbe said to her, "This is Gabas Atzura Lachaymer. I don't know what that means. It's my form overcoming my matter. I don't know what that means. I have no idea. I'm just telling you what the Rebbe said." But somehow that cough was Gabas Atzura Lachaymer. Gabas Atzura Lachaymer means allowing your spirit, your intellect to overcome, to develop your matter to be what it's supposed to be. Again, that's the Aristotelian idea of the imminent theological process of the forms. The form takes over the matter. By the way, I could just give you an example, by the way. Just a nice way of understanding what Aristotle is saying over here. You know, when do you know, let's say if I would say to you, if you look at a chair, right? You look at a chair and you forget that it's made from wood. If let's say you take two slabs of wood, or let's say three slabs, you put two slabs of wood and then a third one on top of it and you look at it. What do you see when you're looking at it? Do you see chair or do you see wood? You see wood, right? You see wood. If you see like this chair over here, right? No insult to the chair, whatever, to the shul, but you see metal, right? You see metal, you see some upholstery, you see right away what it's made up of, right? You see the matter. You see that it's a chair, but it's very clear that it's metal and it's made up of this whatever that color is, maroon, I don't know what to call it, upholstery, right? But you ever go into one of these places where they have gorgeous chairs from like the 17th century, and you look at it, and you don't even see the materials it's made up of. You just see chair. You just see beauty, right? You don't see what the materials it's made up of. When you see a beautiful painting, if you see the paint, you're missing the point, unless these, you know, the impressionists, all these weird modern things, which I haven't managed to figure out yet. But if you see paint, it means that he didn't do a good job. In other words, what are you supposed to see when something is well done? You're not supposed to see the matter, you're just supposed to see the form, right? You'll forgive me for giving this example, but let's say you look at a person's face and like you see nose, right? You look at a person's face and you see, you know, lips, you know, that means that there's something pronounced over there. That means that it's not what we would call that the matter has not become lost its existence to form. True form means that when you see it, you don't see the ingredients of it. You don't see what it's made up of. That means that the matter has become butl, has become nullified to the form. When you see a person, you look at a human being, you see certain human beings, and you look at them, you look at a tzaddik, you look at certain rabbanim, you look at a rav, and you look at him and you see God, elokus, a tzaddik, gemara, Torah, righteousness. You look at certain people, you see different realm, right? You know what I'm talking about? You see certain people, you look at them, you're like, right away, you're like, okay, there's an Eberster, right? You look at them, you don't see, you know, Homo sapien. You don't see, you know, there's a Havamina descendant from monkeys. Some people you look at and you could understand Darwin. Some people you look at and you can. It just doesn't make sense, right? Some people you look at and you see them right away. You're like, you see higher things. You're not aware of the matter. It's the form. That's his Gabbas Atzur L'Chaymer means you don't see anymore the matter. It's the form. He's developed to become a stature. He's become a form of a higher thing. And it doesn't have to be Jewish. It could be a Gentile scholar. You see certain people that they you don't see the human being of them. You see ideas in them. You see what they represent. That means that that's the imminent theological process of the idea. That means that there's a lawfulness. What was Aristotle saying? There's a certain order to the world where things develop to become things that are what? Ideas, not people anymore. And so what I mean, it's no longer the matter of the person. It's the form of the person. That's what you see. And of course, what does that mean to people like us? It means that we have to try to do Hizgabas Atzur L'Chaymer. Hizgabas Atzur L'Chaymer means in very simple English, if you understand what I meant by the chair, looking at some chairs you see wood, looking at some chairs you see beauty, right? You don't see the wood anymore. So same thing we have to understand, you know, every bite of a hamburger is like more Chaymer, is more person, makes that the more person in me becomes more pronounced, the more I become connected to physicality. The more that I become connected to taivas, to things of this world, that's the chaymer, the matter is becoming stronger. And the more that I connect to elokus, I open up a gemara, I learn seichel, it's tzura. In other words, let's put it like this. The scholastic medieval way of, or in the way of rishonim, of saying yetzer tov and yetzer hara, is chaymer and tzura, matter and form. But it's not just synonymous, you understand? It's not just that instead of saying Yetzer Tov and Yetzer Hara, so now there's the medieval commentator says matter and form. Do you understand why it's a much deeper vart? Yetzer Tov and Yetzer Hara is just saying that I am conflicted by conflicting inclinations. I have two inclinations that are conflicting. Yetzer Tov and Yetzer Hara have like, you know, the little cute little devil on one shoulder with the tail with the triangle at the end and the pitchfork and the horns. And then the other one that also has my face with the little halo on it on the other shoulder, right? So I have two little inclinations that are telling me to do two opposite things. Come the Rishonim, based on Aristotle, who's based on Yiddishkeit, whatever, but the saying is Gabas, it's Tzur and Chaymer. It's not two inclinations. It is, are you developing into what you're supposed to be? Are you refining oneself to become that you're not just a human anymore? You're an idea. You're an ideal. You're humanity. Or am I making that the matter becomes more pronounced? Let's go weiter. That was in the Middle Ages. With the arrival of modern classical physics, the concept of lawfulness was identified with the mechanical causality formulated by Galileo and Newton. Came along Galileo and even more Newton, Newtonian physics. Newton came along and showed essentially that the world is one big machine. This is no longer very popular, especially since the Big Bang, the Big Bang theory, and it's been proven, etc. But when Newton came along, we have to understand when the Enlightenment saw that Newton came, even though he was a person that believed in God, and he showed with his physics, with his laws, that the whole world is one big machine. It was a huge challenge to religion, but the idea is that there's the idea of causality. Causality means that X will always equal Y. Newton showed it's all just laws. It's all just laws. This one causes that one, it's just a machine. This goes to this, and this goes to that. It's all just one big machine. Causality. Anyone familiar with the philosophy of Martin Buber? He writes about the darkness of the world of causality. When the world becomes a great big it, right? When there's no thou, there's no you, and there's just an it. And the world of causality is the darkness of the world of causality, the darkness of living in the world of a machine. Where one thing just causes the other, that there's no, there's this fatalistic tragic situation where the world is just a machine where there's nothing that you can really change. And Newton came along and he said that this lawfulness, this orderness that the Rav is speaking about over here, it's all just laws. It's all just a machine. Modern physics showed that most of what Newton said is not, much of it is not true. More recently, the modern metaphysical school, which concerns itself with the absolute, has espoused the nearest Italian concept of the lawfulness of the essences. And here I must admit, I do not understand exactly what the Rav is referring to over here. I don't know what he means here over here exactly. He's speaking of the modern metaphysical school, concerns itself with the absolute, seems to be saying Hegel. Hegel was about the absolute we spoke about. He was modern metaphysical, the idea of the absolute, that everything is revolving into absolute spirit, etc. But I don't understand what that has to do with the lawfulness of the essences. I don't know what that means. I'm not sure. However, no matter how diverse these various concepts of causality are, they all reveal the basic tendency of cognitive man, the search for the ordered and fixed in existence. He is profoundly engaged in rendering an accounting of the world and charts out for himself a structured plan of reality enclosed in borders of order and law, whose ultimate status cannot be denied. He wants laws. Cognition for him consists in discovering the secret, solving the riddle, hidden, buried, deep in reality, precisely through the cognition of the scientific order and pattern of the world. In a word, the act of cognitive man is one of revelation and disclosure. That's what he's seeking out to find. That's cognitive man. Now here's what gets really beautiful, in my opinion. The homo religiosus acts differently. Religious man is not seeking to file the whole all of reality into a file box. When he confronts God's world, when he gazes at the myriads of events and phenomena occurring in the cosmos, he does not desire to transform the secrets embedded in creation into simple equations that a mere tyro is capable of grasping, that a machine, the mind could grasp. On the contrary, homo religiosus is intrigued by the mystery of existence. The mysterium tremendum, that's from Rudolf Otto, from the idea of the holy. The mysterium tremendum, the tremendous mystery. And he wants to emphasize that mystery. He gazes at that which is obscure without the intent of explaining it and inquires into that which is concealed without the intent of receiving the reward of clear understanding. Religious man, he's not looking to inquire. He gazes at the mystery for what purpose? What are the words the Rav says? He wants to emphasize that mystery. He's not looking to understand why. Why is that? Why? Why is religious man like that? Let's read the next paragraph. The dynamic relationship that exists between the subject knower and the object known, meaning the person and the world, the objects that the religious man is viewing. The religious person comes upon beauty in the world, something in the world, grandeur, the object known. That relationship expresses itself for homo religiosus not in the desire and ability of the subject to comprehend the object, but on the contrary, in accepting the fascinating eternal mystery that envelops the object. Why? Oh. So, the truth is, to really be a religious person in this way that the Rav is speaking about over here, and again, we will remind ourselves in footnote 4 that the Rav went on a whole tirade against romanticism, right? But it's very clear that what he's saying over here is that the idea that many philosophers have explained that to be a truly religious person, the temperament of a religious person, one has to have the same temperament of a poet. A poet does not seek to have clarity. A poet seeks to revel in the ambiguity of what he's saying. What's a poem? A poem is not just, you know, information. A poem is not just trying to impart information. That's not a poem. A poem is trying to glorify the beauty and the mystery of something, not to quantify it. The most famous, probably one of the most famous, but definitely the most astounding romantic poet was John Keats. There's a very famous concept that modern-day psychologists are speaking about and appreciating even more. John Keats has a famous letter that he wrote to his brothers, and he spoke about what's called negative capability. Negative capability. I'm going to quote to you. He writes, he speaks about restraining the instinctive demand for clarity, to retain and be receptive to the marvel of the natural world, and to reject that drive to always try to formulate categorical knowledge, to try to put theories in everything. And he says, quote, to live with ambivalence, called negative capability, meaning that man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, and doubts without any of the irritable reaching after fact and reason. That a person, again, man is capable of being in uncertainties, mysteries, and doubts without any of the irritable reaching after fact and reason. It irritates a poet. Man's innate desire to reach after fact and reason irritates a poet. He says, with a great poet, the sense of beauty overcomes every other consideration, or rather, obliterates all considerations. Though that's the ultimate romantic speaking over here, that with a real poet, the sense of beauty overcomes all of the considerations, or rather obliterates all considerations. That, you know, imagine living such a life with that temperament. That's a pretty profound life, but it's a pretty difficult life, right? To seek to live in such a way that one is irritated by fact and reason. To revel in the mystery of it. Not to try to categorize it, to have everything has to have categorical knowledge, to allow the negative capability, man's ability to transcend, and not to try to put things into boxes. You could understand that only then could one really appreciate the depth of humanity of the world, not to, like we spoke about before, not to try to categorize and to put everything into boxes. Then you're able to see the depth that things have. I saw, by the way, very recently, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, published a wonderful book called The Great Partnership. And basically what he wants to say over there is this whole, we spoke about it already many times, this whole quote-unquote clash between science and religion is ridiculous because they're using two different senses of man. It's like comparing apples and oranges. It's not a clash. It's two different aspects of how a human being is supposed to live. There's such a thing called reason, the brain. The brain cannot tell you the ultimate source and ultimate meaning of things. The brain is able to categorize and put things into boxes, like the Rav is saying about cognitive man. But then there are things that the brain can't reach. And that's what religion is speaking about. So they're supposed to go together. And he writes it beautifully. It's wonderful in that book over there. But I'm going to ask you to indulge me. We have a couple of minutes left. This idea of allowing oneself to be receptive, to be open, to retain that being open to wonder and to this, to not being able to define things, or like the Rav says over here, to emphasize the mystery. So more than any other philosopher that writes about this in an unbelievable way was Heschel. Rabbi Abram Joshua Heschel, one of his famous quotes, he says, "I never asked for God," listen, it's a pretty hush of a thing, "I never asked God for wealth, for wisdom, for power, or for fame. I asked for wonder, and he gave it to me." He asked for wonder, to be in a constant state of wonder. Our goal should be to live life in radical amazement. Get up in the morning and look at the world in a way that takes nothing for granted. Everything is phenomenal. Everything is incredible. Never treat life casually. To be spiritual is to be amazed. Because we understand, why does the religious man love that mystery? We'll speak more about this next week more, but the idea is because that speaks of its creator. That speaks of God. It talks, that hints to the fact of God that's in it. And I need to recommend, I'm going to ask you to indulge, I'm going to read a little from it, but his wonderful book called Man Is Not Alone. In his book Man Is Not Alone, which is a philosophy of religion, Heschel speaks about that this aspect of wonder, or what he calls the sense of the ineffable. The sense of the ineffable means sensing that there's something that can't be defined in the world. What the Rav is calling that mystery, that he wants to emphasize that mystery, that is the entrance into a real religious connection with God. Now here I need to explain. When we speak about entering into a religious connection, what it means to be religious, here I am specifically saying there is a difference between the Hasidic and the Misnagdic approach. There is the scientific, rational, scholastic, Misnagdic approach of approaching just with intellect and Shulchan Aruch, etc. Here I'm speaking about the romantic / Hasidic approach, to have a religious connection, which means to be fascinated by God. To approach God, to have a real deep connection with God, means to not stick with the world as is, but to allow the mystery of the world to speak of Hashem. And Heschel, in his book, which I recommend, the first chapter is called The Sense of the Ineffable. And I'm going to ask you to indulge me and allow me to read a couple. I'm going to skip around in that first chapter because some of the things that he writes over there, in my opinion, some of the most beautiful sentences that were ever penned by a human being. And again, he's saying that this is the gateway. By the way, Plato said that wonder is the beginning of all philosophy. All philosophy begins with that sense of wonder, of that mystery, of not taking things for granted, of trying to understand that mystery. And Heschel writes, Rabbi Heschel writes, that that sense of the ineffable, that sense of mystery, is what is going to allow a person to come into a relationship with God, of being face to face with God. Allowing that mystery of the world and the beauty of the world, that undefined, what Keats called the negative capability of a human being, to not fall into that trap of quantifying everything, but rather reveling in that beauty of the world and that mystery and that fascinating non-defined world, that's the entrance way to God. So I recommend reading the whole thing, what he writes over there, Man Is Not Alone. Let me read to you some of the sentences here. We take it for granted that man's mind should be sensitive to nature's loveliness. We take it equally for granted that a person who is not affected by the vision of the earth and sky, who has no eyes to see the grandeur of nature and to sense the sublime, however vaguely, is not human. A person, we take it for granted, a person that doesn't appreciate the earth and the sky at all is not really human. But why? What does it do for us? The awareness of grandeur does not serve any social or biological purpose. Man is very rarely able to portray his appreciation of the sublime to others or to add it to a scientific knowledge. Why then expose ourselves to the disquieting provocation of something that defies our drive to know? You know what he's saying? Read it again. Why then expose ourselves? Why should we look at the beauty of nature? Why should we face that mystery of the world? Why then expose ourselves to the disquieting provocation of something that defies our drive to know, as the Rav is saying over here, to something which may even fill us with fright, with melancholy, or resignation? We insist that it is unworthy of man not to take notice of the sublime. What characterizes man is not only his ability to develop words and symbols, but also his being compelled to draw a distinction between the utterable and the unutterable, to be stunned by that which is, but cannot be put into words. We say that a human being, it's a characteristic of man to be able to say there is something unutterable, there's something that I can't define, there's something that's beyond me. That's an attribute of man, of a human being, to sense the sublime. It is the sense of the sublime that we have to regard as the root of man's creative activities in art, thought, and noble living. Just as no flower has ever fully displayed the hidden vitality of the earth, so has no work of art ever brought to expression the depth of the unutterable, in the sight of which the souls of saints, poets, and philosophers live. I'm going to say that again. Just as no flora, no flower, has ever fully displayed the hidden vitality of the earth, so has no work of art ever brought to expression the depth of the unutterable, in the sight of which the souls of saints, poets, and philosophers lived. Saints, poets, and philosophers lived their life in the sight of the depth of the unutterable. The attempt to convey what we see and cannot say is the everlasting theme of mankind's unfinished symphony, a venture in which adequacy is never achieved. The stirring in our hearts when watching the star-studded sky is something no language can declare. What smites us with unquenchable amazement is not that which we grasp and are able to convey, but that which lies within our reach, but beyond our grasp. Not the quantitative aspect of nature, but something qualitative. Not what is beyond the range in time and space, but the true meaning, source, and end of being, in other words, the ineffable. The ineffable inhabits the magnificent and the common, the grandiose and the tiny facts of reality alike. In other words, where do you encounter the mystery? Where do you encounter the unutterable? In the great and the small, in the details of life. Some people are only able to sense this quality at distant intervals and extraordinary events. Others sense it in the ordinary events, in every fold, in every nook, day after day, hour after hour. They hear the stillness that crowds the world in spite of our noise, in spite of our greed. Did you hear that? Say it again. Those people that hear the ineffable, that are able to sense it all the time, they hear the stillness that crowds the world in spite of our noise, in spite of our greed. Slight and simple as things may be, a piece of paper, a morsel of bread, a word, a sigh, they hide and guard a never-ending secret, a glimpse of God, a kinship with the spirit of being, an internal flash of the will. And then Heschel goes on to give advice, how to become this religious man. Part company with preconceived notions. Suppress your leaning to reiterate and to know in advance of your seeing. Try to see the world for the first time with eyes not dimmed by memory or volition. Try to see the world for the first time with eyes not dimmed by memory and or volition and mind, and you will detect that you and the things that surround you, trees, birds, chairs, are like parallel lines that run close and never meet. Your pretense of being acquainted with the world is quickly abandoned. And then he goes on, I could go on. He goes on to say, and then you reach the ayin. Then you come to that nothingness. Then you come to the mi bara ela, who? The one that created it all. That is the gateway, that wonder, that mystery that we have to retain every day of our life. And then Mitzvah Hashem will be zeicha to that time when Hashem will show us from that wonder, from that mystery, he'll reveal himself to us with Mashiach Tzikamash. Huh? Yeah, he's wonderful. Yeah, really, yeah.
My father's proofreads them all for him.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. I was on this, you know, with the Milo Chodesh and Shabbos with the Greeks, I thought that the Rosh Tevis of Milo Chodesh Shabbos and the ten letters, Milo Chodesh Shabbos, is Mashiach. And why were they snagged? Because